This is Glenn Duns, speaking medical editor with Australian Family Physician, and I'm speaking with Dr. Sally Bell regarding her article on hepatitis C infection, which is due to appear in the July issue of Australian Family Physician. And thank you for agreeing to speak with me, Dr. Bell.
It's a pleasure, Glenn. Thanks very much for having us.
Great. Now, first question I have is, how common is hepatitis C infection in Australia?
Well, actually, this is quite a common infection, and we see that there's over 200,000 people living with hepatitis C virus in Australia, most of whom know about the diagnosis, but about 15% of whom don't. And we do see new infections, approximately 10,000 per year, and the majority of those are in young people who are currently injecting drugs.
Okay. What is the natural history of hepatitis C infection once someone has acquired it? What path do they tend to follow?
So we know that only a small percentage of people will in fact present with an acute hepatitis. Probably about 15% of people present to a medical practitioner with an illness. Usually that's fatigue, feeling a bit off colour, loss of appetite, and sometimes jaundice. In fact, we know that presenting with acute hepatitis is associated with a better outcome, and some of those people will clear the virus. But overall, we think only 20 to 25% of people clear the virus after they first meet it, and therefore 75% of people will go on to have ongoing chronic hepatitis. This means that they produce an immune response against the virus and that gradually they accumulate damage to the liver. But it is a slow process, and we know that the cirrhosis rates at about 20 years are somewhere between 5 and 10%.
Okay. And of those people who develop cirrhosis, a certain percentage will also move on to develop hepatocellular carcinoma?
Yeah, so once you've developed cirrhosis, then as you lose more and more liver cells, you're at risk of liver failure. And we see that the move from compensated cirrhosis to decompensated cirrhosis can take somewhere around 10 years. But that this is a little bit variable. It's quicker in people who still have ongoing active viral infection, and so they've got inflammation in the liver with an elevated ALT, and it's quicker in those people who have other forms of liver disease like alcohol complicating their hepatitis C infection.
Okay. Who should be screened? What sort of risk factors are associated with the development or acquisition of hepatitis C infection?
So we see hepatitis C infection primarily in people who have injected drugs in the past or currently, and that includes people who use drugs intranasally. So there's a large cohort of people who've had a past injecting history. Now, most people won't volunteer that, so it often needs to be actively questioned, maybe just a single episode or a couple of episodes back when they were younger, but that does put them at risk. Blood products have been screened since 1990, so those people who had blood transfusions prior to that date who haven't been tested should also receive testing. And we see that migrants from high prevalence regions are also at risk, and these high prevalence regions are areas like Pakistan, Egypt, the Mediterranean, Eastern Europe, North Africa, and Southern Asia. So there is a higher incidence in those countries, and we're not quite sure why, but often it's to do with iatrogenic medical procedures or unsterile cultural procedures.
Is there any, I just had a patient recently who had blood transfusions in the 1960s and presented with LFT elevation. Is it possible, is there any idea of when hepatitis C first started to contaminate the blood products?
Well, we know that certainly the first reports of transfusion-associated hepatitis occur right back into the 50s and 60s, and so it's quite possible that some of that was hepatitis C. So, yes, anyone who's had a transfusion definitely should be checked, and people who on regular testing are found to have abnormal liver function tests, obviously hepatitis C antibody testing is a very important part of the workup. The only other people we haven't covered are those who've got tattoos. Very small number of people in our cohorts at the hospitals have got tattoo as their only risk factor. We see some hepatitis C in the prison system. So if there's a history of incarceration, that's another good reason to test.
Okay. And as the initial assessment, what tests should be ordered by the general practitioner as part of the initial assessment?
So initially, the simplest test is a hepatitis C antibody, and this just shows whether you've been exposed to the virus. So it doesn't differentiate between whether you've been exposed recently or whether you've been exposed in the past. And it never becomes abnormal. Even if you clear the virus with treatment, it will remain positive. Following that, we would normally, if we find a positive antibody, we would go on, obviously, to do the liver function tests, and then we would look for the presence of the virus with a hepatitis C RNA PCR test, and that's indicative of chronic current infection.
Mm-hmm. Are there any other tests that the general practitioner should be ordering initially? Or
I think these days, once you've established the diagnosis of hepatitis C, it is helpful to look at two other tests. One is the hepatitis C genotype.
Mm-hmm.
This is hepatitis C does mutate, and it therefore changes, and it comes as a little family of subviruses. And the commonest two genotypes in Australia are genotype 1 and genotype 3.
Mm-hmm.
And there are major differences in the ease of treatment and the kinds of treatment that we use for both of these genotypes. So it's important to know which genotype you have, and that's reasonably easy blood test to do, and that means that when you do refer someone for assessment, we can give them much more specific information about the type of treatment that they might need.
Mm-hmm.
The other useful test is a viral load, and once again, this has implications for the success of treatment. People with high viral loads, just a little bit harder to treat than those with low viral loads, and the cutoff is somewhere around the 400,000 international unit mark.
Okay, great. And so we talked about initial assessment and who should be referred for further assessment and treatment. I'm assuming anybody with hepatitis C infection should be.
Yeah, I think in these days and day and age, we're now moving into an era where we think that all patients with hepatitis C should be able to be offered therapy at some point, and that this is a potentially curable disease. So there's been a big improvement in the efficacy of the treatment, and we're just starting to see new treatments that are much more tolerable than the previous ones. So we do think that it's worthwhile having a management plan for all patients with hepatitis C.
Mm.
I guess those comments need to be adjusted for the fact that we need to treat some people more urgently than others.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really quite important to establish whether someone has advanced liver disease, in which case their treatment is much more urgent than someone with mild liver disease.
Mm-hmm.
And we would initially do that by examining the patient, looking for signs of chronic liver disease like palm erythema, Dupuytren's, clubbing. We would look to see whether there was muscle wasting, and then we would examine for the presence of splenomegaly or ascites. All of those features are quite suggestive of cirrhosis. And then we would look carefully at the synthetic function of the liver with an albumin and an INR. We do a full blood count. Just look at the platelet count, because if you've got splenomegaly, you'll clear your platelets more quickly from the blood, and your platelet count will drop. So that's a very useful marker of portal hypertension.
Mm-hmm.
And that can give us a hint about people who might be cirrhotic, who don't know that they're cirrhotic. And those people definitely need to be referred.
Mm-hmm. And so you mentioned the significance and success of current treatments. What are the current treatments, and what are the success rates associated with them?
Yeah, the current treatment, standard treatment, is changing rapidly.
Mm.
So currently we have pegylated interferon and ribavirin, and this is given sort of over a period of 6 to 12 months depending on the genotype. So for type 1 disease, it's given for 12 months. For type 3 disease, just for 6 months. And for people with cirrhosis, we give it for 12 months.
Mm-hmm.
The overall all-comers rate of cure with this form of therapy is about 50%, slightly less for people with cirrhosis, slightly more for people with genotype 3A who are easier to treat.
Mm-hmm.
We have recently had approved on the PBS new drugs, these two drugs, telaprevir and braseprevir. are given in addition to ribavirin and interferon. We just use one or the other. So this is called triple therapy. And this has increased the cure rates from about the 50% mark to about 70%. And it offers an opportunity to shorten treatment to 6 months in about half the patients. So these do represent a marked improvement in the efficacy, but they are still quite difficult to tolerate, with anemia and rash being the common side effects. So although they have been a significant step forward, they're still quite hard work and do need to be carefully considered. Very good for people, though, with genotype 1 infection who have got advanced fibrosis and who need treatment now. What we are expecting over the next 3 to 5 years is the advent of interferon-free therapy, so that we will be able to eradicate the virus with two or three oral medications directed at the enzymes that the virus uses to replicate. So this will be similar to the type of highly active antiretroviral therapy that we use for HIV. So exactly the same concept, but for hepatitis C. Trials with these agents are underway in most major centres in Australia at the moment, but they are not yet licensed on the PBS. We're expecting the first ones to perhaps come through in about end of 2014 or early 2015.
And in your experience, out of the patients that do commence these therapies, what percentage of them tend to drop out or not tolerate the therapy?
Well, I think we've got a lot better at preparing people for treatment before we start. And so the number of people who drop out is actually relatively small, probably less than 5%. Mm-hmm. So the preparation for treatment is quite important. When we're using interferon, we like people to have a stable mental state, mm-hmm. and because interferon can cause depression or worsen coexisting depression. Mm-hmm. So we often will make sure people are taking their antidepressant therapy, and we will discuss with them using antidepressant therapy if necessary during therapy. Mm-hmm. The other common side effects are fatigue. It's important to prepare patients for not taking on too much extra during therapy. And the remaining side effects really relate to the degree of underlying liver disease. So we do see older patients and people with cirrhosis tolerate the treatment less well. But we have specialist nurses who will help the patient through treatment, and using the team approach, we have very good adherence rates.
And in your article, you also you mentioned that because of the common route of transmission, hepatitis C can be associated with HIV infection as well. And are there particular issues associated with co-infection, and are there other comorbidities that should be considered?
Yes, we know that people with co-infection are likely to have more advanced liver disease than people who just have infection with a single virus. So, in fact, for them, assessment of the severity of their liver disease is very important. They do respond to treatment in the same way as people who have mono-infection, so they should be considered for therapy. As the new agents come through, we will see some drug-drug interactions, and there'll need to be some careful assessments for people who have HIV co-infection, because they're already usually on complex regimes. So I think the era of all oral therapy for people with co-infection will just take a little bit longer to get to the clinic.
Okay. And I think as you mentioned previously, the presence of oftentimes psychiatric problems in these patients and the potential for exacerbation of depression. Are there any other comorbidities that we should be concerned about? Or?
Yeah, look, I think the other main thing is alcohol consumption. So the commonest two liver diseases in Australia are alcoholic liver disease and hepatitis C. And people who have more advanced disease often have both. So we do need to make sure that patients with hepatitis C have a good alcohol history taken and are counselled to reduce their alcohol intake. Those who've got cirrhosis should probably not drink at all. Those who don't have cirrhosis should drink less than the NH and MRC recommendations of 5 standard drinks a week. And we do suggest that while people are on treatment, they don't drink at all.
Great. Now, just in terms of take-home points, what should doctors take home regarding hepatitis C infection, the main points?
I think that the main thing is to think about screening people. So we know that the cohort of people who are at most at risk are born somewhere between sort of 1940, early 40s, right through to sort of the 1970s. That's the cohort who had peak involvement in the injecting drug use epidemic. Anyone who actually volunteers a history of injecting drug use, people with tattoos, and people who are born overseas who might not expect to have testing. I think it's well worthwhile. We know that a lot of people worry about sexual transmission, but in fact this is a very unusual route of transmission in hepatitis C, and it's usually that both parties have the same risk factor, commonly injecting drug use. So I think screening's the first take-home point. Think about doing the test in your patients who've got abnormal liver function tests or a risk factor. I think the second take-home point is that it's important to prepare people for treatment. And to do that, you need to assess their liver and see whether they have cirrhosis. Examination is a big part of that. Ultrasound is very helpful. And some of the basic tests that I went through earlier, albumin, INR, platelet count, can also help you out. There are new forms of non-invasive screening for cirrhosis, including a test called FibroScan. This is a type of ultrasound, and it's now in most of the major centres around Australia. So access to this is still relatively limited, but it's a nice, quick, easy way of assessing fibrosis without having to have a liver biopsy. So once you've assessed someone's underlying fibrosis status, then I think preparing them for treatment, talking to them about willingness for treatment and modifying some of their other risk factors for liver disease. So we like to see people get their mental health under control, reduce their alcohol intake. Controlling obesity and diabetes is also an important factor that we didn't discuss before. And then I think discussing with your friendly gastroenterologist or hepatologist about these patients and referring them for treatment, and letting them know that there are new treatments that are available. Many people have heard about the old treatments and have been put off by the side effect profile, but the message hasn't reached them that there are new treatments coming. So I think it's now is a good time to think about referring your patients.
So at this point with the treatments, when a patient has progressed to cirrhosis, it's still not too late to treat.
Absolutely not. Those people who've got compensated cirrhosis will tolerate interferon-based therapies in most cases and can still be treated with the standard therapy. And those people with more advanced cirrhosis are a difficult category. Usually they will not tolerate interferon therapy. At the moment, we don't have oral medication for them. But we're hoping that in the short term there will be some medication orally that is effective without too much in the way of side effects. So I think that once again, if you do discover someone who has decompensated cirrhosis, so ascites, the presence of portal hypertension, then it's still important to refer those people.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Bell. That was extremely informative, and I appreciate your time.
Well, thanks very much, Glenn, and I hope that's covered most of the major points.
Thank you.